Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. ZabarsCoffee.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
Deborah and I spoke freely in English, a language in which, by that age, I expressed myself more easily than Bengali. I felt protective of her, aware that she was unwanted, that she was resented, aware of the nasty things people said. We exchanged what I believed were secret smiles, and in those moments, I felt that she understood me better than anyone else in the world.
You are listening to Rita Wolf, reading from Jhumpa Lahiri's story, Hell Heaven, a powerful tale to which we devote this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Jhumpa Lahiri, who was born in London of Indian parents, raised in Rhode Island, and now lives in Brooklyn, is surely one of the luminous stars of contemporary American fiction. Her debut collection, Interpreter of Maladies, won her a Pulitzer Prize, the Penn Hemingway Award, and designation as the New Yorker Magazine Debut of the Year. Her novel, The Namesake, also won a slew of awards and was made into the movie of the same name, directed by Mira Nair. From her breathtaking second story collection, Unaccustomed Earth, we hear a classic Lahiri tale of expatriate Indian families in America. Hell Heaven is read for us by the actress Rita Wolf, who appeared in the film My Beautiful Laundrette. Jhumpa Lahiri's Hell Heaven.
Pranab Chakraborty wasn't technically my father's younger brother. He was a fellow Bengali from Calcutta who had washed up on the barren shores of my parents' social life in the early 70s, when they lived in a rented apartment in Central Square and could number their acquaintances on one hand. But I had no real uncles in America, and so I was taught to call him Pranab Kaku. Accordingly, he called my father Shamalda, always addressing him in the polite form, and he called my mother Bodhi, which is how Bengalis are supposed to address an older brother's wife, instead of using her first name, Aporna. After Pranab Kaku was befriended by my parents, he confessed that on the day we met him, he had followed my mother and me for the better part of an afternoon around the streets of Cambridge, where she and I tended to roam after I got out of school. He had trailed behind us along Massachusetts Avenue and in and out of the Harvard Co-op, where my mother liked to look at discounted housewares. He wandered with us into Harvard Yard, where my mother often sat on the grass on pleasant days and watched the stream of students and professors filing busily along the paths, until finally, as we were climbing the steps to widen a library so that I could use the bathroom, he tapped my mother on the shoulder and inquired, in English, if she might be a Bengali. The answer to his question was clear, given that my mother was wearing the red and white bangles unique to Bengali married women and a common tangil sari, and had a thick stem of vermilion powder in the center parting of her hair and the full round face and dark eyes that are so typical of Bengali women. He noticed the two or three safety pins she wore, fastened to the thin gold bangles that were behind the red and white ones, which she would use to replace a missing hook on a blouse or to draw a string through a petticoat at a moment's notice, a practice he associated strictly with his mother and sisters and aunts in Calcutta. Moreover, Pranab Kaku had overheard my mother speaking to me in Bengali, telling me that I couldn't buy an issue of Archie at the co-op. But back then, he also confessed, he was so new to America that he took nothing for granted and doubted even the obvious. My parents and I had lived in Central Square for 3 years prior to that day. Before that, we lived in Berlin, where I was born, and where my father had finished his training in microbiology before accepting a position as a researcher at Mass General. And before Berlin, my mother and father had lived in India, where they were strangers to each other, and where their marriage had been arranged. Central Square is the first place I can recall living, and in my memories of our apartment in a dark brown shingled house on Ashburton Place, Pranab Kaku is always there. According to the story he liked to recall often, my mother invited him to accompany us back to our apartment that very afternoon and prepared tea for the two of them. Then, after learning that he had not had a proper Bengali meal in more than 3 months, she served him the leftover curried mackerel and rice that we had eaten for dinner the night before. He remained into the evening for a second dinner after my father got home, and after that he showed up for dinner almost every night, occupying the fourth chair at our square formica kitchen table and becoming a part of our family in practice as well as in name. He was from a wealthy family in Calcutta and had never had to do so much as pour himself a glass of water before moving to America to study engineering at MIT. Life as a graduate student in Boston was a cruel shock, and in his first month he lost nearly 20 pounds. He had arrived in January in the middle of a snowstorm, and at the end of the week he had packed his bags and gone to Logan, prepared to abandon the opportunity he'd worked toward all his life, only to change his mind at the last minute. He was living on Trowbridge Street in the home of a divorced woman with two young children who were always screaming and crying. He rented a room in the attic and was permitted to use the kitchen only at specified times of the day and instructed always to wipe down the stove with Windex and a sponge. My parents agreed that it was a terrible situation, and if they'd had a bedroom to spare, they would have offered it to him. Instead, they welcomed him to our meals and opened up our apartment to him at any time. And soon it was there he went between classes and on his days off, always leaving behind some vestige of himself, a nearly finished pack of cigarettes, a newspaper, a piece of mail he had not bothered to open, a sweater he had taken off and forgotten in the course of his stay. I remember vividly the sound of his exuberant laughter and the sight of his lanky body slouched or sprawled on the dull, mismatched furniture that had come with our apartment. He had a striking face with a high forehead and a thick moustache and overgrown, untamed hair that my mother said made him look like the American hippies who were everywhere in those days. His long legs jiggled rapidly up and down whenever he sat, and his elegant hands trembled when he held a cigarette between his fingers, tapping the ashes into a teacup that my mother began to set aside for this exclusive purpose. Though he was a scientist by training, there was nothing rigid or predictable or orderly about him. He always seemed to be starving, walking through the door and announcing that he hadn't had lunch. And then he would eat ravenously, reaching behind my mother to steal cutlets as she was frying them, before she had a chance to set them properly on a plate with red onion salad. In private, my parents remarked that he was a brilliant student, a star at Jadavpur, who had come to MIT with an impressive assistantship. But Pranab Kaku was cavalier about his classes, skipping them with frequency. "These Americans are learning equations I knew at Usha's age," he would complain. He was stunned that my second grade teacher didn't assign any homework, and that at the age of 7, I hadn't yet been taught square roots or the concept of pi. He appeared without warning, never phoning beforehand, but simply knocking on the door the way people did in Calcutta and calling out, "Bodhi," as he waited for my mother to let him in. Before we met him, I would return from school and find my mother with her purse in her lap and her trench coat on, desperate to escape the apartment where she had spent the day alone. But now I would find her in the kitchen, rolling out dough for luchis, which she normally made only on Sundays for my father and me, or putting up new curtains she'd bought at Woolworths. I did not know back then that Pranab Kaku's visits were what my mother looked forward to all day, that she changed into a new sari and combed her hair in anticipation of his arrival, and that she planned, days in advance, the snacks she would serve him with such nonchalance, that she lived for the moment she heard him call out, "Bodhi!" from the porch, and that she was in a foul humor on the days he didn't materialize. It must have pleased her that I looked forward to his visits as well. He showed me card tricks and an optical illusion in which he appeared to be severing his own thumb with enormous struggle and strength, and taught me to memorize multiplication tables well before I had to learn them in school. His hobby was photography. He owned an expensive camera that required thought before you pressed the shutter, and I quickly became his favorite subject, round-faced, missing teeth, my thick bangs in need of a trim. They are still the pictures of myself I like best, for they convey that confidence of youth I no longer possess, especially in front of a camera. I remember having to run back and forth in Harvard Square as he stood with the camera trying to capture me in motion, or posing on the steps of university buildings and on the street and against the trunks of trees. There is only one photograph in which my mother appears. She is holding me as I sit straddling her lap, her head tilted toward me, her hands pressed to my ears as if to prevent me from hearing something. In that picture, Branogaku's shadow, his two arms raised at angles to hold the camera to his face, hovers in the corner of the frame, his darkened, featureless shape superimposed on one side of my mother's body. It was always the three of us. I was always there when he visited. It would have been inappropriate for my mother to receive him in the apartment alone. This was something that went without saying. They had in common all the things she and my father did not. A love of music, film, leftist politics, poetry. They were from the same neighborhood in North Calcutta, their family homes within walking distance, the facades familiar to them once the exact locations were described. They knew the same shops, the same bus and tram routes, the same holes in the wall for the best jalebis and Mughlai paratas. My father, on the other hand, came from a suburb 20 miles outside Calcutta, an area that my mother considered the wilderness. And even in her bleakest hours of homesickness, she was grateful that my father had at least spared her a life in the stern house of her in-laws, where she would have had to keep her head covered with the end of her sari at all times and use an outhouse that was nothing but a raised platform with a hole, and where, in the rooms, there was not a single painting hanging on the walls. Within a few weeks, Branogaku had brought his reel-to-reel over to our apartment, and he played for my mother medley after medley of songs from the Hindi films of their youth. They were cheerful songs of courtship, which transformed the quiet life in our apartment and transported my mother back to the world she'd left behind in order to marry my father. She and Branogaku would try to recall the scene, in which movie the songs were from, who the actors were and what they were wearing. My mother would describe Raj Kapoor and Nargis singing under umbrellas in the rain, or Devanand strumming a guitar on the beach in Goa. She and Branogaku would argue passionately about these matters, raising their voices in playful combat, confronting each other in a way she and my father never did. Because he played the part of a younger brother, she felt free to call him Pranob, whereas she never called my father by his first name. My father was 37 then, 9 years older than my mother. Branogaku was 25. My father was a lover of silence and solitude. He had married my mother to placate his parents. They were willing to accept his desertion as long as he had a wife. He was wedded to his work, his research, and he existed in a shell that neither my mother nor I could penetrate. Conversation was a chore for him. It required an effort he would prefer to expend in the lab. He disliked excess in anything, voiced no cravings or needs apart from the frugal elements of his daily routine, cereal and tea in the morning, a cup of tea after he got home, and two different vegetable dishes every night with dinner. He did not eat with the reckless appetite of Branogaku. My father had a survivor's mentality. From time to time, he liked to remark, in mixed company and often with no relevant provocation, that starving Russians under Stalin had resorted to eating the glue off the back of their wallpaper. One might think that he would have felt slightly jealous, or at the very least, suspicious, about the regularity of Pranukaku's visits and the effect they had on my mother's behavior and mood. But my guess is that my father was grateful to Pranukaku for the companionship he provided, freed from the sense of responsibility he must have felt for forcing her to leave India, and relieved, perhaps, to see her happy for a change. In the summer, Branogaku bought a navy blue Volkswagen Beetle and began to take my mother and me for drives through Boston and Cambridge, and soon outside the city, flying down the highway. He would take us to India Tea and Spices in Watertown, and one time he drove us all the way to New Hampshire to look at the mountains. As the weather grew hotter, we started going once or twice a week to Walden Pond. My mother always prepared a picnic of hard-boiled eggs and cucumber sandwiches and talked fondly about the winter picnics of her youth, grand expeditions with 50 of her relatives, all taking the train into the West Bengal countryside. Pranab Kaku listened to these stories with interest, absorbing the vanishing details of her past. He did not turn a deaf ear to her nostalgia like my father, or listen uncomprehending like me. At Walden Pond, Pranab Kaku would coax my mother through the woods and lead her down the steep slope to the water's edge. She would unpack the picnic things and sit and watch us as we swam. His chest was matted with thick dark hair all the way to his waist. He was an odd sight, with his pole-thin legs and a small flaccid belly, like an otherwise svelte woman who has had a baby and not bothered to tone her abdomen. "You're making me fat, Bodhi," he would complain after gorging himself on my mother's cooking. He swam noisily, clumsily, his head above the water. He didn't know how to blow bubbles or hold his breath, as I had learned in swimming class. Wherever we went, any stranger would have naturally assumed that Pranab Kaku was my father, that my mother was his wife. It is clear to me now that my mother was in love with him. He wooed her as no other man had, with the innocent affection of a brother-in-law. In my mind, he was just a family member, a cross between an uncle and a much older brother. For in certain respects, my parents sheltered and cared for him in much the same way they cared for me. He was respectful of my father, always seeking his advice about making a life in the West, about setting up a bank account and getting a job, and deferring to his opinions about Kissinger and Watergate. Occasionally, my mother would tease him about women, asking about female Indian students at MIT, or showing him pictures of her younger cousins in India. "What do you think of her?" she would ask. "Isn't she pretty?" She knew that she could never have Pranab Kaku for herself, and I suppose it was her attempt to keep him in the family. But, most important, in the beginning, he was totally dependent on her, needing her for those months in a way my father never did in the whole history of their marriage. He brought to my mother the first and, I suspect, the only pure happiness she ever felt. I don't think even my birth made her as happy. I was evidence of her marriage to my father, an assumed consequence of the life she had been raised to lead. But Pranab Kaku was different. He was the one totally unanticipated pleasure of her life. In the fall of 1974, Pranab Kaku met a student at Radcliffe named Deborah, an American, and she began to accompany him to our house. I called Deborah by her first name, as my parents did, but Pranab Kaku taught her to call my father Shamalda and my mother Bodhi, something with which Deborah gladly complied. Before they came to dinner for the first time, I asked my mother, as she was straightening up the living room, if I ought to address her as Deborah Kakima, turning her into an aunt as I had turned Pranab Kaku into an uncle. "What's the point?" my mother said, looking back at me sharply. "In a few weeks, the fun will be over and she'll leave him." And yet, Deborah remained by his side, attending the weekend parties that Pranab Kaku and my parents were becoming more involved with, gatherings that were exclusively Bengali, with the exception of her. Deborah was very tall, taller than both my parents, and nearly as tall as Pranab Kaku. She wore her long, brass-coloured hair centre-parted, as my mother did, but it was gathered into a low ponytail instead of a braid, or it spilled messily over her shoulders and down her back in a way that my mother considered indecent. She wore small silver spectacles and not a trace of makeup, and she studied philosophy. I found her utterly beautiful, but according to my mother, she had spots on her face and her hips were too small. For a while, Pranab Kaku still showed up once a week for dinner on his own, mostly asking my mother what she thought of Deborah. He sought her approval, telling her that Deborah was the daughter of professors at Boston College, that her father published poetry, and that both her parents had PhDs. When he wasn't around, my mother complained about Deborah's visits, about having to make the food less spicy, even though Deborah said she liked spicy food, and feeling embarrassed to put a fried fish head in the dal. Pranab Kaku taught Deborah to say, "Khub bhalo," and acha, and to pick up certain foods with her fingers instead of with a fork. Sometimes they ended up feeding each other, allowing their fingers to linger in each other's mouth, causing my parents to look down at their plates and wait for the moment to pass. At larger gatherings, they kissed and held hands in front of everyone. And when they were out of earshot, my mother would talk to the other Bengali women. He used to be so different. I don't understand how a person can change so suddenly. It's just hell heaven, the difference, she would say, always using the English words for her self-concocted backward metaphor. The more my mother began to resent Deborah's visits, the more I began to anticipate them. I fell in love with Deborah, the way young girls often fall in love with women who are not their mothers. I loved her serene grey eyes, the ponchos and denim wrap skirts and sandals she wore, her straight hair that she let me manipulate into all sorts of silly styles. I longed for her casual appearance. My mother insisted, whenever there was a gathering, that I wear one of my ankle-length, faintly Victorian dresses, which she referred to as maxis, and have party hair, which meant taking a strand from either side of my head and joining them with a barrette at the back. At parties, Deborah would eventually politely slip away, much to the relief of the Bengali women with whom she was expected to carry on a conversation, and she would play with me. I was older than all my parents' friends' children, but with Deborah, I had a companion. She knew all about the books I read, about Pippi Longstocking and Anne of Green Gables. She gave me the sorts of gifts my parents had neither the money nor the inspiration to buy. A large book of Grimm's fairy tales with watercolour illustrations on thick silken pages. Wooden puppets with hair fashioned from yarn. She told me about her family, three older sisters and two brothers, the youngest of whom was closer to my age than to hers. Once, after visiting her parents, she brought back three Nancy Drews, her name written in a girlish hand at the top of the first page, and an old toy she'd had, a small paper theatre set with interchangeable backdrops, the exterior of a castle and a ballroom and an open field. Deborah and I spoke freely in English, a language in which, by that age, I expressed myself more easily than Bengali, which I was required to speak at home. Sometimes she asked me how to say this or that in Bengali. Once she asked me what Oshumpo meant. I hesitated, then told her it was what my mother called me if I had done something extremely naughty. And Deborah's face clouded. I felt protective of her, aware that she was unwanted, that she was resented, aware of the nasty things people said. Outings in the Volkswagen now involved the four of us, Deborah in the front, her hand over Pranab Gaku's while it rested on the gear shift, my mother and I in the back. Soon my mother began coming up with reasons to excuse herself, headaches and incipient colds, and so I became part of a new triangle. To my surprise, my mother allowed me to go with them to the Museum of Fine Arts and the Public Garden and the aquarium. She was waiting for the affair to end, for Deborah to break Pranab Kaku's heart and for him to return to us, scarred and penitent. I saw no sign of their relationship foundering. Their open affection for each other, their easily expressed happiness, was a new and romantic thing to me. Having me in the back seat allowed Pranab Kaku and Deborah to practice for the future, to try on the idea of a family of their own. Countless photographs were taken of me and Deborah, of me sitting on Deborah's lap, holding her hand, kissing her on the cheek. We exchanged what I believed were secret smiles, and in those moments I felt that she understood me better than anyone else in the world. Anyone would have said that Deborah would make an excellent mother one day, but my mother refused to acknowledge such a thing. I did not know at the time that my mother allowed me to go off with Pranab Kaku and Deborah because she was pregnant for the fifth time since my birth and was so sick and exhausted and fearful of losing another baby that she slept most of the day. After 10 weeks, she miscarried again and was advised by her doctor to stop trying. By summer, there was a diamond on Deborah's left hand, something my mother had never been given. Because his own family lived so far away, Pranab Kaku came to the house alone one day to ask for my parents' blessing before giving her the ring. He showed us the box, opening it and taking out the diamond nestled inside. "I want to see how it looks on someone," he said, urging my mother to try it on. But she refused. I was the one who stuck out my hand, feeling the weight of the ring suspended at the base of my finger. Then he asked for a second thing. He wanted my parents to write to his parents, saying that they had met Deborah and that they thought highly of her. He was nervous, naturally, about telling his family that he intended to marry an American girl. He had told his parents all about us, and at one point my parents had received a letter from them, expressing appreciation for taking such good care of their son and for giving him a proper home in America. "It needn't be long," Pranabkaku said. "Just a few lines. They'll accept it more easily if it comes from you." My father thought neither ill nor well of Deborah, never commenting or criticizing as my mother did. But he assured Pranabkaku that a letter of endorsement would be on its way to Calcutta by the end of the week. My mother nodded her assent. But the following day, I saw the teacup Pranabkaku had used all this time as an ashtray in the kitchen garbage can in pieces, and three band-aids taped to my mother's hand. Pranabkaku's parents were horrified by the thought of their only son marrying an American woman, and a few weeks later, our telephone rang in the middle of the night. It was Mr. Chakraborty telling my father that they could not possibly bless such a marriage, that it was out of the question, that if Pranabkaku dared to marry Deborah, he would no longer acknowledge him as a son. Then his wife got on the phone, asking to speak to my mother, and attacked her as if she were an intimate, blaming my mother for allowing the affair to develop. She said that they had already chosen a wife for him in Calcutta, that he'd left for America with the understanding that he'd go back after he had finished his studies and marry this girl. They had bought the neighboring flat in their building for Pranab and his betrothed, and it was sitting empty, waiting for their return. "We thought we could trust you, and yet you have betrayed us so deeply," his mother said, taking out her anger on a stranger in a way she could not on her son. "Is this what happens to people in America?" For Pranabkaku's sake, my mother defended the engagement, telling his mother that Deborah was a polite girl from a decent family. Pranabkaku's parents pleaded with mine to talk him out of it, but my father refused, deciding that it was not their place to get embroiled. "We are not his parents," he told my mother. "We can tell him they don't approve, but nothing more." And so my parents told Pranabkaku nothing about how his parents had berated them and blamed them and threatened to disown Pranabkaku, only that they had refused to give him their blessing. In the face of this refusal, Pranabkaku shrugged. "I don't care. Not everyone can be as open-minded as you," he told my parents. "Your blessing is blessing enough." After the engagement, Pranabkaku and Deborah began drifting out of our lives. They moved in together to an apartment in Boston in the South End, a part of the city my parents considered unsafe. We moved as well to a house in Natick. Though my parents had bought the house, they occupied it as if they were still tenants, touching up scuff marks with leftover paint and reluctant to put holes in the walls. And every afternoon when the sun shone through the living room window, my mother closed the blinds so that our new furniture would not fade. A few weeks before the wedding, my parents invited Pranabkaku to the house alone, and my mother prepared a special meal to mark the end of his bachelorhood. It would be the only Bengali aspect of the wedding. The rest of it would be strictly American, with a cake and a minister and Deborah in a long white dress and veil. There is a photograph of this dinner, taken by my father, the only picture to my knowledge in which my mother and Pranabkaku appear together. The picture is slightly blurry. I remember Pranabkaku explaining to my father how to work the camera, and so he is captured looking up from the kitchen table and the elaborate array of food my mother had prepared in his honor, his mouth open, his long arm outstretched, and his finger pointing, instructing my father how to read the light meter or some such thing. My mother stands beside him, one hand on top of his head, in a gesture of blessing, the first and last time she was to touch him in her life. "She will leave him," my mother told her friends afterwards. "He is throwing his life away." The wedding was at a church in Ipswich, with a reception at a country club. It was going to be a small ceremony, which my parents took to mean 100 or 200 people, as opposed to 300 or 400. My mother was shocked that fewer than 30 people had been invited, and she was even more perplexed than honoured that of all the Bengalis Pranab Kaku knew by then, we were the only ones on the list. At the wedding, we sat like the other guests, first on the hard wooden pews of the church, and then at a long table that had been set up for lunch. Though we were the closest thing Pranab Kaku had to a family that day, we were not included in the group photographs that were taken on the grounds of the country club, with Deborah's parents and grandparents and her many siblings, and neither my mother nor my father got up to make a toast. My mother did not appreciate the fact that Deborah had made sure that my parents, who did not eat beef, were given fish instead of filet mignon like everyone else. She kept speaking in Bengali, complaining about the formality of the proceedings and the fact that Pranab Kaku, wearing a tuxedo, barely said a word to us because he was too busy leaning over the shoulders of his new American in-laws as he circled the tables. As usual, my father said nothing in response to my mother's commentary. Quietly and methodically working through his meal, his fork and knife occasionally squeaking against the surface of the china because he was accustomed to eating with his hands. He cleared his plate and then my mother's, for she had pronounced the food inedible, and then he announced that he had overeaten and had a stomachache. The only time my mother forced a smile was when Deborah appeared behind her chair, kissing her on the cheek and asking if we were enjoying ourselves. When the dancing started, my parents remained at the table, drinking tea, and after two or three songs, they decided that it was time for us to go home. My mother shooting me looks to that effect across the room, where I was dancing in a circle with Pranab Kaku and Deborah and the other children at the wedding. I wanted to stay, and when, reluctantly, I walked over to where my parents sat, Deborah followed me. "Bodhi, let Usha stay. She's having such a good time," she said to my mother. "Lots of people will be heading back your way. Someone can drop her off in a little while." But my mother said no. I had had plenty of fun already and forced me to put on my coat over my long puff-sleeved dress. As we drove home from the wedding, I told my mother, for the first but not the last time in my life, that I hated her. The following year, we received a birth announcement from the Chakrabortis. A picture of twin girls, which my mother did not paste into an album or display on the refrigerator door. The girls were named Srabani and Sabitri, but were called Bonnie and Sarah. Apart from a thank you card for our wedding gift, it was their only communication. We were not invited to the new house in Marblehead, bought after Pranab Kaku got a high-paying job at Stone and Webster. For a while, my parents and their friends continued to invite the Chakrabortis to gatherings, but because they never came or left after staying only an hour, the invitation stopped. Their absences were attributed by my parents and their circle to Deborah, and it was universally agreed that she had stripped Pranab Kaku not only of his origins, but of his independence. She was the enemy, he was her prey. And their example was invoked as a warning and as vindication that mixed marriages were a doomed enterprise. Occasionally, they surprised everyone, appearing at a pujo for a few hours with their two identical little girls who barely looked Bengali and spoke only English and were being raised so differently from me and most of the other children. They were not taken to Calcutta every summer. They did not have parents who were clinging to another way of life and exhorting their children to do the same. Because of Deborah, they were exempt from all that, and for this reason, I envied them. "Usha, look at you, all grown up and so pretty," Deborah would say whenever she saw me, rekindling, if only for a minute, our bond of years before. She had cut off her beautiful long hair by then and had a bob. "I bet you'll be old enough to babysit soon," she would say. "I'll call you. The girls would love that." But she never did. I began to grow out of my girlhood, entering middle school and developing crushes on the American boys in my class. The crushes amounted to nothing. In spite of Deborah's compliments, I was always overlooked at that age. But my mother must have picked up on something, for she forbade me to attend the dances that were held the last Friday of every month in the school cafeteria, and it was an unspoken law that I was not allowed to date. "Don't think you'll get away with marrying an American the way Pranab Kaku did," she would say from time to time. I was 13, the thought of marriage irrelevant to my life. Still, her words upset me, and I felt her grip on me tighten, She would fly into a rage when I told her I wanted to start wearing a bra, or if I wanted to go to Harvard Square with a friend. In the middle of her arguments, she often conjured Deborah as her antithesis, the sort of woman she refused to be. If she were your mother, she would let you do whatever you wanted, because she wouldn't care. Is that what you want, Usha? A mother who doesn't care? When I began menstruating the summer before I started ninth grade, my mother gave me a speech, telling me that I was to let no boy touch me. And then she asked if I knew how a woman became pregnant. I told her what I had been taught in science about the sperm fertilizing the egg. And then she asked if I knew how exactly that happened. I saw the terror in her eyes. And so, though I knew that aspect of procreation as well, I lied and told her it hadn't been explained to us. I began keeping other secrets from her, evading her with the aid of my friends. I told her I was sleeping over at a friend's when really I went to parties, drinking beer and allowing boys to kiss me and fondle my breasts and press their erections against my hip as we lay groping on a sofa or the back seat of a car. I began to pity my mother. The older I got, the more I saw what a desolate life she led. She had never worked, and during the day she watched soap operas to pass the time. Her only job every day was to clean and cook for my father and me. We rarely went to restaurants, my father always pointing out, even in cheap ones, how expensive they were compared to eating at home. When my mother complained to him about how much she hated life in the suburbs and how lonely she felt, he said nothing to placate her. "If you are so unhappy, go back to Calcutta," he would offer, making it clear that their separation would not affect him one way or the other. I began to take my cues from my father in dealing with her, isolating her doubly. When she screamed at me for taking too long on the telephone or for staying too long in my room, I learned to scream back, telling her that she was pathetic, that she knew nothing about me, and it was clear to us both that I had stopped needing her, definitively and abruptly, just as Pranab Kaku had. Then, the year before I went off to college, my parents and I were invited to the Chakraborty's home for Thanksgiving. We were not the only guests from my parents' old Cambridge crowd. It turned out that Pranab Kaku and Deborah wanted to have a sort of reunion of all the people they had been friendly with back then. Normally, my parents did not celebrate Thanksgiving. The ritual of a large sit-down dinner and the foods that one was supposed to eat was lost on them. They treated it as if it were Memorial Day or Veterans Day, just another holiday in the American year. But we drove out to Marblehead, to an impressive stone-faced house with a semicircular gravel driveway clogged with cars. The house was a short walk from the ocean. On our way, we had driven by the harbour overlooking the cold, glittering Atlantic, and when we stepped out of the car, we were greeted by the sound of gulls and waves. Most of the living room furniture had been moved to the basement, and extra tables joined to the main one to form a giant U. They were covered with tablecloths, set with white plates and silverware, and had centerpieces of gourds. I was struck by the toys and dolls that were everywhere, dogs that shed long yellow hairs on everything. All the photographs of Bonnie and Sarah and Deborah decorating the walls, still more plastering the refrigerator door. Food was being prepared when we arrived, something my mother always frowned upon. The kitchen, a chaos of people and smells and enormous dirtied bowls. Deborah's family, whom we remembered dimly from the wedding, was there. Her parents and her brothers and sisters, and their husbands and wives and boyfriends and babies. Her sisters were in their 30s, but like Deborah, they could have been mistaken for college students, wearing jeans and clogs and fisherman sweaters. And her brother Matty, with whom I had danced in a circle at the wedding, was now a freshman at Amherst, with wide-set green eyes and wispy brown hair and a complexion that reddened easily. As soon as I saw Deborah's siblings joking with one another as they chopped and stirred things in the kitchen, I was furious with my mother for making a scene before we left the house and forcing me to wear a shalwar kameez. I knew they assumed from my clothing that I had more in common with the other Bengalis than with them. But Deborah insisted on including me, setting me to work peeling apples with Matty, and out of my parents' sight, I was given beer to drink. When the meal was ready, we were told where to sit, in an alternating boy-girl formation that made the Bengalis uncomfortable. Bottles of wine were lined up on the table. Two turkeys were brought out, one stuffed with sausage and one without. My mouth watered at the food, but I knew that afterward, on our way home, my mother would complain that it was all tasteless and bland. "Impossible," my mother said, shaking her hand over the top of her glass when someone tried to pour her a little wine. Deborah's father, Jean, got up to say grace and asked everyone at the table to join hands. He bowed his head and closed his eyes.
"Dear Lord, we thank you today for the food we are about to receive," he began.
My parents were seated next to each other, and I was stunned to see that they complied, that my father's brown fingers lightly clasped my mother's pale ones. I noticed Matty, seated on the other side of the room, and saw him glancing at me as his father spoke. After the chorus of amens, Jean raised his glass and said,
"Forgive me, but I never thought I'd have the opportunity to say this. Here's to Thanksgiving with the Indians."
Only a few people laughed at the joke. Then Pranab Kaku stood up and thanked everyone for coming. He was relaxed from alcohol, his once wiry body beginning to thicken. He started to talk sentimentally about his early days in Cambridge, and then suddenly he recounted the story of meeting me and my mother for the first time, telling the guests about how he had followed us that afternoon. The people who did not know us laughed, amused by the description of the encounter and by Pranab Kaku's desperation. He walked around the room to where my mother was sitting and draped a lanky arm around her shoulder, forcing her for a brief moment to stand up.
"This woman," he declared, pulling her close to his side, "this woman hosted my first real Thanksgiving in America. It might have been an afternoon in May, but that first meal at Bodhi's table was Thanksgiving to me. If it weren't for that meal, I would have gone back to Calcutta."
My mother looked away, embarrassed. She was 38, already going grey, and she looked closer to my father's age than to Pranab Kaku's. Regardless of his waistline, he retained his handsome, carefree looks. Pranab Kaku went back to his place at the head of the table next to Deborah and concluded,
"And if that had been the case, I'd have never met you, my darling."
And he kissed her on the mouth in front of everyone, to much applause, as if it were their wedding all over again. After the turkey, smaller forks were distributed and orders were taken for three different kinds of pie, written on small pads by Deborah's sisters, as if they were waitresses. After dessert, the dogs needed to go out, and Pranab Kaku volunteered to take them.
"How about a walk on the beach?" he suggested,
and Deborah's side of the family agreed that that was an excellent idea. None of the Bengalis wanted to go. Preferring to sit with their tea and cluster together, at last, at one end of the room, speaking freely after the forced chit-chat with the Americans during the meal. Matty came over and sat in the chair beside me that was now empty, encouraging me to join the walk. When I hesitated, pointing to my inappropriate clothes and shoes, but also aware of my mother's silent fury at the sight of us together, she said, "I'm sure Deb can lend you something." So I went upstairs, where Deborah gave me a pair of her jeans and a thick sweater and some sneakers, so that I looked like her and her sisters. She sat on the edge of the bed, watching me change, as if we were girlfriends, and she asked if I had a boyfriend. When I told her no, she said, "Matty thinks you're cute." "He told you?" "No, but I can tell." As I walked back downstairs, emboldened by this information, in the jeans I'd had to roll up and in which I felt finally like myself, I noticed my mother lift her eyes from her teacup and stare at me. But she said nothing, and off I went with Pranab Kaku and his dogs and his in-laws along a road and then down some steep wooden steps to the water. Deborah and one of her sisters stayed behind to begin the clean-up and see to the needs of those who remained. Initially, we all walked together in a single row across the sand, but then I noticed Matty hanging back, and so the two of us trailed behind, the distance between us and the others increasing. We began flirting, talking of things I no longer remember, and eventually we wandered into a rocky inlet, and Matty
fished a joint out of his pocket. We turned our backs to the wind and smoked it, our cold fingers touching in the process, our lips pressed to the same damp section of the rolling paper. At first, I didn't feel any effect, but then, listening to him talk about the band he was in, I was aware that his voice sounded miles away and that I had the urge to laugh, even though what he was saying was not particularly funny. It felt as if we were apart from the group for hours, but when we wandered back to the sand, we could still see them, walking out onto a promontory to watch the sunset. It was dark by the time we all headed back to the house, and I dreaded seeing my parents while I was still high. But when we got there, Deborah told me that my parents, feeling tired, had left, agreeing to let someone drive me home later. A fire had been lit, and I was told to relax and have more pie, as the leftovers were put away and the living room slowly put back to order. Of course, it was Matty who drove me home, and sitting in my parents' driveway, I kissed him, at once thrilled and terrified that my mother might walk onto the lawn in her nightgown and discover us. I gave Matty my phone number, and for a few weeks I thought of him constantly and hoped, foolishly, that he would call. In the end, my mother was right. And 14 years after that Thanksgiving, after 23 years of marriage, Branukaku and Deborah got divorced. It was he who had strayed, falling in love with a married Bengali woman, destroying two families in the process. The other woman was someone my parents knew, though not very well. Deborah was in her 40s by then, Bonnie and Sarah away at college. In her shock and grief, it was my mother whom Deborah turned to, calling and weeping into the phone. Somehow, through all the years, she had continued to regard us as quasi-in-laws, sending flowers when my grandparents died and giving me a compact edition of the OED as a college graduation present. "You knew him so well. How could he do something like this?" Deborah asked my mother. And then, "Did you know anything about it?" My mother answered truthfully that she did not. Their hearts had been broken by the same man, only my mother's had long ago mended. And in an odd way, as my parents approached their old age, she and my father had grown fond of each other, out of habit, if nothing else. I believe my absence from the house once I left for college had something to do with this, because over the years when I visited, I noticed a warmth between my parents that had not been there before. A quiet teasing, a solidarity, a concern when one of them fell ill. My mother and I had also made peace. She had accepted the fact that I was not only her daughter, but a child of America as well. Slowly, she accepted that I dated one American man and then another, and then yet another, that I slept with them, and even that I lived with one, though we were not married. She welcomed my boyfriends into our home, and when things didn't work out, she told me I would find someone better. After years of being idle, she decided when she turned 50 to get a degree in library science at a nearby university. On the phone, Deborah admitted something that surprised my mother, that all these years she had felt hopelessly shut out of a part of Pranabkaku's life. "I was so horribly jealous of you back then for knowing him, understanding him in a way I never could. He turned his back on his family, on all of you, really, but I still felt threatened. I could never get over that." She told my mother that she had tried for years to get Pranabkaku to reconcile with his parents, and that she had also encouraged him to maintain ties with other Bengalis, but he had resisted. It had been Deborah's idea to invite us to their Thanksgiving. Ironically, the other woman had been there too. "I hope you don't blame me for taking him away from your lives, Bodhi. I always worried that you did." My mother assured Deborah that she blamed her for nothing. She confessed nothing to Deborah about her own jealousy of decades before, only that she was sorry for what had happened, that it was a sad and terrible thing for their family. She did not tell Deborah that a few weeks after Pranabkaku's wedding, while I was at a Girl Scouts meeting and my father was at work, she had gone through the house, gathering up all the safety pins that lurked in drawers and tins and adding them to the few fastened to her bracelets. When she'd found enough, she pinned them to her sari one by one. attaching the front piece to the layer of material underneath, so that no one would be able to pull the garment off her body. Then she took a can of lighter fluid and a box of kitchen matches and stepped outside into our chilly backyard, which was full of leaves needing to be raked. Over her sari, she was wearing a knee-length lilac trench coat, and to any neighbour, she must have looked as though she'd simply stepped out for some fresh air. She opened up the coat and removed the tip from the can of lighter fluid and doused herself, then buttoned and belted the coat. She walked over to the garbage barrel behind our house and disposed of the fluid, then returned to the middle of the yard with the box of matches in her coat pocket. For nearly an hour, she stood there, looking at our house, trying to work up the courage to strike a match. It was not I who saved her, or my father, but our next-door neighbour, Mrs. Holcomb, with whom my mother had never been particularly friendly. She came out to rake the leaves in her yard, calling out to my mother and remarking how beautiful the sunset was. "I see you've been admiring it for a while now," she said. My mother agreed, and then she went back into the house. By the time my father and I came home in the early evening, she was in the kitchen boiling rice for our dinner, as if it were any other day. My mother told Deborah none of this. It was to me that she confessed, after my own heart had been broken by a man I'd hoped to marry.
Hell Heaven by Jhumpa Lahiri from the collection Unaccustomed Earth was read by Rita Wolf. After a short break, we'll be back in conversation with the author. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
আহা তোমার সঙ্গে প্রাণের খেলা প্রিয় আমার ওগো প্রিয় বড় উতলায় আজ ভরা নামার খেলাতে হার
Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. ZabarsCoffee.com. Hell Heaven, the Jhumpa Lahiri story we've just heard, was presented at an evening at Symphony Space at which the author was our guest. After the performance, Jhumpa Lahiri sat with me and talked on stage. Here's part of what we discussed. So, welcome to our stage, to which you are no stranger. Your stories take us into a very particular world with its traditions, family expectations. In what way do you think the experience of the Bengali immigrants to the USA has been different from that of other immigrant groups? What I mean is that my parents got off a boat in America, and they and their generation of immigrants didn't ever think of going back, even for a visit, whereas the for a lot of reasons, and your characters often do return for a visit, as you did. Do you think this makes them a very distinctive subset of immigrants to America?
I think every set is distinct in its own way. I think the world within a world that I grew up in could be characterized in certain ways that I think I try to put into the stories, that they typically came for their educations to have a slightly better life, but it wasn't a matter of life or death. For most of the families I knew growing up were very much like my own family, in that the husband came with a particular job and a specific thing to do, and the wife came in order to raise the family and be a wife.
Let me turn to the story that we've just heard. Where did the beginning of this story happen in your mind?
I think this story is my attempt to better understand my earliest memories. And really? And not that the story itself is from any true situation, but my earliest memories are of the year we lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They're very dim, but they're present. And then surrounding all of those very vague impressions are a wealth of stories from not only my mother, but her very close friend, who actually lived with us for that year. A few years down the road, when I was a bit older, one of those students married an American woman, and the sort of scandal of that. So I think it was working with those things that I heard, and also my own personal curiosity.
One of the women working in our literary department said to me in the intermission, "Oh, the mothers in her stories." And one of the young men who works in the literary department here said, "Those fathers, they are such shadowy figures. Do you think you do more mother-daughter stuff?"
Yeah, well, I think this is the first book where I was writing about families. There was a point when I was working on the stories and I really thought, this is what I want to write about. This is what I want to try to better understand. Everything I have written in my life has been inspired by my mother and father. It was my need to try to better understand my parents in some sense that really drove me to write stories from the very beginning, even when I wasn't writing about parent-child relationships. My parents were what I was always meditating about on some level, their existence, their reality, and then eventually their reality as it trickled down to my reality. And I think in this book, that's what is coming together finally. Those two things are, I've tried to knit them up in a way that I wasn't able to in the first book or even in the second book. I think this is, I hope, you know, comes across.
I am so pleased that you were here to share with us today. Thanks so much for coming.
A talk with Jhumpa Lahiri on stage at Selected Shorts. If you enjoyed this Jhumpa Lahiri story, there's another one of her tales on our CD, Fictions for Our Times. Information about that can be had at selectedshorts.org.
Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Support for this program also comes from Audiophile Magazine. For audiobook information and reviews, visit audiophilemagazine.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.